speaking with Anthony Shadid, foreign correspondent for the New York Times. And so you're based, is it mainly in Beirut now?
You know, our home is in Beirut, and I also have a house in Boston. But, you know, our home is in Beirut, although I spend more of my time in Baghdad.
Yeah. Okay. You've spent a lot of time in Iraq over the last 10 years, and there's one particular town you've been back to a number of times since the U.S. invasion in 2003. How did you stumble upon this town?
You know, this town it's a nondescript town. You wouldn't find it on any maps, really. It's called Dhuluya. It's on the banks of the Tigris River. I had gone there for the first time, I think, back in May of 2003 to report on what was then the American military's biggest response to the insurgency. It was an operation called Peninsula Strike. It attracted some attention at the time, although it's really a footnote to the war at this point. But that was what brought me there in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And what? Why was that place of interest?
You know, I'm always interested in the aftermath of the story. I think there's the event, and then there's the aftermath. And as a journalist, I always find the aftermath much more interesting. So I had gone to this town a few days after the operation had come to an end, and really I just kind of stumbled on what turned out to be condolences. A tent had been set up to receive mourners who were paying their condolences for a 15-year-old boy who had been killed. And right then you got the feeling that something bigger was afoot. I started to talk to people, and you realize that not only was this boy killed, but two other people had been killed.
Killed how?
They were killed by the American military during this operation Peninsula Strike. And as the conversations unfolded, you realize that there was a lot of anger directed not only at the Americans, but also at an informer that the Americans had used, a man named Sabah. And there was a demand for vengeance in some respects, and they couldn't do anything about the American soldiers. They were long gone at that point, but they could do something about this informer named Sabah.
Everyone knew this man had informed for the United States.
You know, they recognized him pretty quickly. He was seen. He had a bag over his head, but they could tell from his gait as he walked past people who were laying on the ground. More distinctly, they could tell that he had lost part of his finger in an accident, and they recognized this. And then they heard his voice, too. And at one point, in fact, during the interrogations, when this informer was working with the Americans, people started shouting out, "That's Sabah, that's Sabah."
And he must have realized pretty fast that he was soon going to be a dead man.
You know, what was his motivation? That was one part of the story that I never completely understood. Was it money? You know, perhaps. There was rumors that he was also trying to settle scores with some of the people in the town. It may have been just trying to get in good with the people he thought were in charge.
So after this man, Sabah, had been fingered, essentially, as an informant, what was the talk in the town?
Well, it was, you know, even that first day that I was in Dhuluya at that funeral tent, the tent for condolences, people were whispering about Sabah's fate. And I remember one person telling me that he'll be ripped to pieces, but not yet. And then I don't remember the exact words of another man, but it was along the lines of, he's a dead man. Nothing would happen, though, for weeks. And I actually went back to Dhuluya a couple times in the interim, and I remember asking people, and, you know, people didn't seem to know what had happened to him. And then one day in the summer in June, I was back in Dhuluya, and I was talking to a friend that I'd made there, and he said, yeah, he was killed, and he was killed by his father.
Wow. And it's an incredible story. Why would his father end up killing him?
You know, it was such a dramatic, you know, it's hard to overstate how dramatic the change in Dhuluya and the rest of Iraq, for that matter, was after Saddam Hussein fell. There was a vacuum, pretty much. And into this vacuum, this lawless vacuum, came the tribal leaders, the kind of traditional leaders of the town, the clan leaders. And they had a sense, a kind of frontier notion of justice. And it was very clear there was that tribal issues had entered into this. The boy that was killed was of one tribe called Ani. The informer, Sabah, was from the Djibouti tribe. And so it quickly became a tribal vendetta. And these tribal leaders, these clan leaders, said to Sabah's father, they gave him a choice. Either he kill his son, or they, the tribal leaders, will kill everyone in his family. And so this father was faced with a choice of, you know, does he kill his son or does he face the death of everybody he knows, everybody in his family, everyone close to him? And he made that choice, a biblical choice. And he and his other son, you know, led Sabah out early in the morning. And the way the story was told to me is the father fired, I think, two or three times, and Sabah wasn't dead. He fell to the ground but was still breathing, and the father collapsed at that point and couldn't go any further. And the other brother had to fire the fatal shot.
I can't imagine a worse thing to have to do for a father or for a brother.
You know, it was one of the most haunting, and probably is the most haunting story I ever reported. And I went back after Sabah was killed, and I went to see the father. And actually, the father sat down with me, and he said words that I haven't forgotten to this day. I think maybe the most haunting words I've ever heard as a reporter. He told me that not even the prophet Abraham had to kill his son. And then he paused, and I remember his eyes, you know, glistened a little bit, and he said there was no other choice.
Wow. Did anyone, I mean, as this was brewing in the town, and clearly people were talking about this, was it just kind of universal decision among all townspeople that that Sabah had to be killed, that his own family had to do it, or were there other people who said, no, this is wrong?
You know, there was a protest raised by all people. There was a protest that came out by a man named Mullah Natham. He was a cleric in the town. And I really didn't understand that at the point when I was reporting the story, but Mullah Natham actually became a much more important character in the town. He thought these tribal leaders were trying to cover up their own crimes, that they had worked with the Americans, that they were trying to hide what they had done. And he tried to intervene. In fact, he had set up a meeting with the father the next day, but this, as the cleric put it to me, this man named Mullah Natham, that Kalashnikov was faster than I was. And it's interesting. I reported this story back in 2003. I wrote it for the Washington Post, and I also wrote it in the book that I wrote on Iraq, Night Draws Near. What happened after I wrote the story for the Washington Post, though, was I think a lot of people saw the story as an example of brutality, that this is how brutal Iraq had become in the aftermath of the invasion and the beginning of the occupation. And that really troubled me. That wasn't the intention of the story. And that's not how I saw the story. The story, to me, meant something very, very different. And that was how this very almost, you know, forgettable intervention on the part of the U.S. military, this Operation Peninsula Strike that was quickly forgotten. Like I said, it was a footnote. Unleashed this chain of events, this incredible chain of events that transformed this town in the years that followed. And it was just how the smallest of interventions created the greatest of unintended consequences in the town. And Mullah Natham later became a center of that drama, a center of that sequence of events that were unleashed.
So this preacher tried to stop this vengeance. He tried to stop the people from killing the son. Failed, and what eventually happened to him, to the preacher?
Well, Mullah Natham was very interesting, and when I talked to him, I remember meeting him back in December of 2003, and even then, he knew that things were changing. As he put it to me, Sunnis were now in a Shiite-dominated country. They were an occupied country, occupied by the Americans, and they needed guns. They needed something. They needed people to defend them, and he was already talking about setting up a militia at that point. The months would pass. The months would pass, and Mullah Natham eventually joined one of the insurgent groups that came out.
So even though he had originally argued against the insurgents doing this kind of thing, he joined them.
Well, he actually argued against the tribal leaders ordering the father to kill his son. But the insurgents, in fact, there was kind of a difference between the two. The tribal leaders were what you might call the old guard. They were kind of the old leadership of the town. Mullah Natham, the cleric, and then the insurgents that he joined were the new guard in some respects. And they soon took the town away from the tribal leaders. They became the new power, the new rule in town.
Hmm. So he actually took up a gun then to join the militia?
You know, he was always a little bit dodgy about that when I would ask him about that. But clearly he was one of the insurgent leaders. And they created, in some ways, a reign of terror in this town in the years that followed. It was interesting. Before I get there, Mullah Natham made this point to me later on, but he said the killing of this informer opened the gates to hell. It opened the gates to kill, opened the doors to killing. And once those doors were opened, you couldn't close them again. And it almost foreshadowed what the insurgents became in that town of Dhuluiya in the years that followed. There was a reign of terror and there was killing. And Mullah Natham at least traced it back to the killing of Sabah. Even though he was part of this insurgent leadership, he looked at that as the seminal moment, the beginning of this kind of narrative that was unleashed. And by 2005, 2006, the insurgents were in charge of the town. They ordered anybody working with the police to resign their jobs. If they didn't, they were executed. They ordered people not to smoke in the streets. They basically kind of imposed a draconian, very conservative code of justice, and anybody who violated that was basically killed or maimed.
And how did the townspeople react?
For a while, I think the townspeople thought, they didn't want to be part of it. It was better not to stick out your neck. Maybe the people who they called collaborators and spies were actually collaborators and spies, and they deserved to be killed. But at a certain point, in 2006, 2007, the insurgents went too far. They killed a policeman, a guy named Ibrahim Saleh. He was a beloved figure in the town. He was from a good family. They killed this policeman, and all of a sudden, things turned on a dime, the townspeople had enough, and they basically rebelled. And as they were rebelling, Mullah Nazım understood how things were changing, and he actually switched sides as well. And Mullah Nazım joined what was becoming an American-backed group fighting the insurgency. He became a leader of that American-backed group. So he went from critic to insurgent to American ally. And with Mullah Nazım's help and with this uprising that happened in the town, they soon vanquished the insurgents.
Hmm. And so then what happened in the town at that point?
You know, by then, this is probably 2007 and 2008, Mullah Nazım became the power in town. Again, he was a power in town with the insurgents. Now he was a power in town with the American-backed militia. But he had men under arms under his command. He was the head of the biggest mosque in the town. And pretty much Mullah Nazım's name guaranteed you safe passage through the Uluwiya. I remember coming into the town once in 2009, and all you had to say at the checkpoint outside town was, "I'm going to see Mullah Nazım." And that was enough to get you inside town. Now, Mullah Nazım was, you know, he was a charismatic figure, whatever his past, but he had made some enemies, obviously, by working with the insurgents. And later in 2009, he was arrested. Now, things switch.
He was arrested by whom?
He was arrested by the Iraqi government, but who knows whose, you know, vendettas, whose scores were being settled. And one thing that I think is striking about the whole American experience in Iraq is that, you know, alliances, loyalties, they're all very fleeting. Here's Mullah Nazım, who had worked with the Americans to vanquish the insurgents. Then when he was arrested, the Americans washed their hands of him. In fact, I remember talking to a military spokesman, and he said, you know, it's a matter for the Iraqis. The Iraqi government, you know, was very appreciative at one point of him helping fight the insurgents, but now some score was being settled, and he was on the wrong side of it. So Mullah Nazım soon spent 4 months in jail. And it was really remarkable to me that when he was released, it was already very clear that he was no longer the power in town. You know, Mullah Nazım had his moment, and his moment had passed.
Mm. It's almost as if he lost his moral authority.
That's right. Lost his moral authority and his physical authority. You know, the gunmen he had under him were no longer under his command. And what transpired over that next year was really remarkable to me. And I think it's something that, you know, we often try to make sense of this war. What was this war all about? And I remember as I went back and forth to this town, you know, by 2010, the tribal leaders, the same tribal leaders that back in 2003 had ordered this father to kill his son, were now back in charge. And I remember sitting in lunch with some of these people, and, you know, they were kind of asking the question, what was this all for? You know, 2010 felt like 2003, and why do we have to go through all of what we went through? And it's a question a lot of them were asking. Nothing had really changed, although a lot of people have lost their lives, a lot of blood was shed, and then this father was forced to kill his son. And I went back to that father later on. I wanted to ask him that same question. Well, you know, what was this all for? Why do we have to go through something like this? And, you know, he was still a very angry man, understandably, and he refused to talk to me. He was never rude to me, but it was clear that he didn't want to talk. I remember his brother coming up to us, his son coming up to us, and his son apologized for what he saw as his father being rude and kind of led us outside. And, you know, we talked about it, and you could just tell the pain and the suffering and the hurt and also that sense of injustice that he felt had been imposed upon them, that, you know, this one tiny moment of intervention on the part of the American military that led to this vast, you know, this seismic sequence of events, and it led them back to this point in 2010. Remember, walking with him to the cemetery, walking past the gravestone. They hadn't even, fixed the gravestone, really. And just that anger that this son felt. And there was an overwhelming sense of unrequited vengeance that, you know, the story had not ended, that the vendetta wasn't over. I remember another villager at the time had told me a story about a Bedouin whose father was killed and 40 years had passed, and they asked this Bedouin why he hadn't had vengeance yet. And he said in Arabic that it was still too early and not yet. And I remember hearing that story when I was looking at this brother of the informer as he sat near the gravestone, the marker. And I thought that same idea, that maybe it was still too early, that he hadn't had his vengeance yet.
So it's entirely possible that the U.S. presence in Iraq will be long gone before this bloodletting continues, this act of vengeance
absolutely. And that's what's something that's so striking to me as a reporter there, is that, you know, the invasion is long gone. The occupation is over. You know, the Americans are at least, you know, by treaty supposed to depart, the American military, by the end of next year. But those dynamics, those unintended consequences that we set in motion have only really begun to play themselves out. And this is a generation-long thing, I think, that we're dealing with. And in some respects, we haven't even really seen the full impact of them.
What was it like for you as an American to go and cover this story? I mean, were you... did you feel at risk? Were people angry at you being an American?
You know, to be honest, I didn't always say I was an American to people. You know, if they didn't ask, I wouldn't volunteer it. You know, it was a very...
They didn't know?
You know, I would often say I was Lebanese origin. And one of the great things about being in a post-dictatorship, I guess, is that people don't ask all that many questions. You know, you've learned not to ask too many questions, not to be too curious. So often when I would say that, I'm, you know, of Lebanese descent, people would leave it at that. And it was a good
but they
thing.
Knew you were a reporter.
They knew I was a reporter. They knew I was a foreigner, too. They could hear an accent, obviously. You know, I was there in 2003 when the invasion began, and I guess part of me wants to kind of see it to the end, or however we define that end. And, you know, I think a lot of the reporters who are still there, and there's, you know, there's maybe a dozen or so of us who have kind of seen a lot of this conflict, do want to see it to the end, that they have a kind of an obligation, maybe a responsibility to see how this turns out.
That's interesting. I mean, as a, what, a moral obligation?
You know, I don't know how you would define it. You know, I mean, I guess there is a part of us that, we're reporters, but we're also Americans. And, you know, our country did make a decision to invade another country. And there were vast consequences to that decision. And, you know, I guess it's a moral obligation. I guess it's a desire to have make some kind of reckoning with what we've done. A responsibility on our part to keep telling the story, even after the story, and I think a lot of people's minds is over.
Now, you talked about how angry a lot of these people were, especially the father who was forced to kill his son. Was he angry at you, too, when you came and tried to interview him once again?
You know, I don't think he remembered me from 2003. I think if he remembered me, he would have probably been even angrier. Because he did, I think he did know that a story was written about what happened to his son, and I'm not sure that he was happy about that. So I think it was less, but I don't think he recognized me. And I think it was less anger toward me and more anger at this, you know, almost biblical choice that he was faced with, this injustice. You know, it was, you know, unbelievable injustice. I mean, the people who ordered him to kill his son were actually probably collaborating with the Americans on their own. But they had the power at the time in the village to carry out a judgment like that or to impose a judgment like that.
Were you angry? As you covered these, I mean, you saw the horror that was happening, how this village was ripped up, how probably good people were turned into to villains.
You know, I think every journalist, I think it's probably good for every journalist to have a little bit of outrage in them, things that transpire. Otherwise, you lose that desire to write and to hold people accountable and to, what's the word I'm looking for, to try to find... try to bring some meaning to all these things that are happening. You know, there have been a lot of times that I've been very upset and very angry in Iraq. It's hard to convey how brutalized and how traumatized that country is. It's hard to catalog and to chronicle how many people have actually died since 2003. You don't meet anyone in Baghdad that doesn't have a friend or a relative killed. And that's kind of a sweeping statement, but it's depressingly accurate. And I think there is a little bit of anger of, you know, did all this have to happen? What was this all for? And I'm not sure what the answer is to that. I don't know what the answer is until today.
You know, well, and you've said that you keep going back kind of trying to find some meaning to all this. Is there meaning to be found?
Yeah, maybe there's not. I'll tell you, one word that always struck me, the word is zahamath in Arabic. It's ambiguity. Something's ambiguous. It's unknown. We can't really figure it out. And that word has always struck me. It's always defined a lot of the experience for me, at least in Iraq, is that, you know, all these years later, it's still ambiguous. What's next? You know, what is going to happen? How is this going to turn out? And, you know, there's a very linear sense of things in America, especially when it comes to Iraq. We invaded. We occupied the place. We withdrew. Iraqis are on their own. There's nothing linear about Iraq, though. And I think in a lot of ways, the seminal moments in that country's history haven't even happened yet. I mean, how this is going to turn out, the events that shape that, I think still await us.
Well, and there's also a narrative that's been constructed from the U.S. perspective, and certainly for the people who supported the war, it was, you know, the United States was seen as the liberators. We were coming in to depose an awful tyrant, and we were going to help this country on the road to democracy, and obviously things are way more complicated than that, and... we became occupiers, right?
I think it's such a that's another thing. If you talk about trying to making these kind of more sweeping statements about Iraq, is how much it was dominated by this contest of narratives. You know, as occupier, as liberator, as something in between it. You know, the insurgents tried to make their own narrative. You know, they did it through spectacles of bombings, of car bombings, suicide bombings, what have you. The Americans tried to do it through those images, those kind of lasting images, Saddam's statue falling down, for instance, or as recent as August when the last combat troop the last combat soldier supposedly withdrew. This has been a war of narratives, and those narratives, you know, I think have been a disservice to us in some ways, of really appreciating how ambiguous, how gray Iraq really is. It's not a story of blacks and whites. It's a story of grays, and I think it's gotten in the way of us understanding what we've done and what are the consequences of our actions going to be.
But can a country talk about a war without constructing narratives?
I wonder. You know, I maybe it's not. I guess the narratives are probably inevitable in some ways, and I think it's part of the job as journalists is to try to write against those dominant narratives, especially if those narratives feel, you know, less than truthful. I guess what's more disturbing to me, though, is that, you know, I think back to Vietnam. Of course, I'm too young to have really experienced Vietnam, but there did seem to be a reckoning with Vietnam after that war was over in this country. You know, what was it for? What did it mean? What are its consequences? I don't feel like we've had that reckoning with Iraq, and we certainly haven't had it with Afghanistan, although that war is very much still underway. Are we going to have that reckoning with Iraq? And that's a question I wonder. I wonder if we're going to ask that question of ourselves. You know, what did it mean and what was it all for? You know, what kind of lessons we're going to draw from what's happened there over the past 7 years.
Well, and we tend to focus on what has happened to American soldiers who've gone over there and sort of, you know, the trauma that they've experienced coming home. If they did, in fact, make it home, we tend not to really focus on the people in Iraq.
You know, 100,000 dead. I mean, maybe the number's fewer. Maybe it's more. Maybe it's much more. You know, 100,000 dead in Iraq would be the equivalent of, what, 1 million dead in America. I mean, it's a toll that, you know, a number will never capture. You know, you can only, only the most dramatic stories really convey what has happened to that society, what has happened to that society's fabric, how it's been ripped apart. You can't emerge from that kind of carnage anytime soon. And I think we do it at some level, some moral level. And I'm not sure what the answer is, but there's some kind of moral reckoning I think we need to make with what we've left behind.
Now, the story that you've told is sort of a case study in unintended consequences. And I guess I wonder if that's just always true with war.
I wonder. You know, and I probably haven't covered enough conflicts to answer that question, but, you know, things rarely play out the way they're supposed to play out, that's for sure. And especially when you introduce violence and overwhelming violence into the equation, you know, it creates consequences that none of us could have ever foreseen. You know, I think some colleagues of mine have made the argument that, you know, we couldn't have foreseen what happened in Iraq. Actually, I think we could have foreseen some of what happened in Iraq, certainly. I mean, people knew what might be unleashed. You know, did we understand the scale of the devastation? You know, it's hard to make that argument, but, you know, perhaps we should have.
What about as a journalist? Are there certain lessons that you've learned about what makes good journalism, particularly for a war reporter?
You know, I guess one the kind of rule of thumb that I've learned since 2003 is that we tell small stories to say something bigger. I think that's, you know, that example of Dhuluiya is, you know, whether that story, you know, how effective that story is probably another question. But I think that story does say something very small, and we can be very authoritative in telling that small story. You could capture that small story. It is reportable, and hopefully we can see a bigger lesson from it. I think the biggest mistakes we make as journalists is we try to say too much.
Hmm. And we try to say this war is either good or bad, and you almost can't say that, can you,
right,
as a journalist?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think they, you know, I should probably let readers speak for themselves, but I don't think readers are all that captivated by that kind of story. It's just of hectoring and of lecturing and of this kind of thing. You know, I find much more poignant, much more effective are the stories that, you know, are quieter, that talk of universal experience, of a mother sending her son to fight in war, or a father losing his son in a bombing. These are the stories to me that are in some ways more visceral, but also more understandable.
It's just truly a remarkable story. Thank you very much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.